This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. For 19 years, photographer James Noctway has covered war and the effects of violence on people's lives. His images are not easily forgotten. Dead bodies slumped against walls and shoved by bulldozers into mass graves. Children with limbs hacked off, emaciated victims of famine crawling towards aid, faces pitted by shrapnel. Noctway's photos from Northern Ireland, Lebanon, Nicaragua, South Africa, Rwanda, Chechnya, and Bosnia have won him almost every major photojournalism award, including 5 Robert Capa gold medals from the Overseas Press Club. One critic writes that his work reflects an iconic intensity that at times seems almost religious, appropriate for a man so moved by suffering that he cannot turn away from the tragedies he records. Noctway's work of the past decade is collected in a new book, Inferno. He's also featured in Magnum, a collection of photojournalism from the prestigious Magnum Photo Agency. Noctway is a member of Magnum and is also on contract to Time magazine. I asked him when he first started taking pictures.
I began to teach myself photography after graduating from college in the early 70s, and I took it up quite seriously from the beginning. It was not an outgrowth of an earlier pastime. I started from ground zero as a photographer and taught myself through reading books on the subject, through going to exhibitions, seeing what other photographers could do, being inspired, being challenged. There was a time when I would go to bookshops every day, and I did not have enough money to buy any photography books, but I would stand in the aisles daily and study the books of master photographers to gain inspiration, and it became a kind of free university for me.
Was there one photo or one image that made you decide, this is what I have to do?
I couldn't narrow it down to a single image. It was work done by serious documentary photographers that really helped me expand my vision of what photography could be. The initial inspiration and the tradition in which I wanted to follow was that of the photographers who worked in the Vietnam War. I actually became a photographer to be a war photographer. I felt that their work was so important in shaping public awareness of what was going on there that it actually changed the course of history. And I thought that the social value of that kind of work was so great that that seemed the most worthwhile use of photography, and that's what I wanted to do.
I'd like you to talk about a photo from, it's actually from Zaire, but it was in the context of reporting on the story, the war in Rwanda. You have, you shot a photo of in the background is a bulldozer and a man wearing a hygienic mask over his face, and in the foreground is the back of a dump truck, a corpse, a dead woman, is hanging by her skirt cloth off the back of the truck. Her face is mutilated. Her arm is hanging down limp. I'd like you to talk about your concerns when you take a photo like this, whether there's a tension between documenting the brutality and the inhumanity of this woman's death and the way that her body is treated, and also a concern for preserving the humanity of the victim at the same time. Are there tensions at work when you frame this photo?
There are two things I'm trying to accomplish in terms of photography. One is to document the truth as close as I can get to it. This was a situation in which tens of thousands of people died of cholera in a matter of a few weeks. It was death on a biblical scale following a massive genocide. There was nothing in this situation that could be regarded as in good taste. It was as if the wrath of God had descended upon the perpetrators of a genocide. However, mixed in with the perpetrators were the innocent, and the cholera was taking the guilty and the innocent indiscriminately. The other is to be able to make a connection between the viewer and what I am photographing. I want a human connection to be established. I want there to be a level of compassion and understanding so that someone very far away from those circumstances can relate to it on a human level. I don't try to make pictures that pander to sensationalism. I try and make them very human documents. This is a picture in which people are being buried en masse. The death rate from the cholera epidemic was so high that the bodies were just piling up around the fringes of the refugee camps and further exacerbating the epidemic. The French army came in and organized mass burials, and people were literally being bulldozed into mass graves. This woman is actually not suspended from the back of a truck, but she's hanging off the front of a blade of a bulldozer. And as ghastly as it is, I still think you can see something in her, in the form, the shape into which she's been contorted, that is still human, that still can help bridge a gap between the viewer and the subject.
I suppose part of your mission is to show suffering so that whoever's looking at the photo can't look away. They can't excuse it. You can't distance themselves from it. But there must be a thin line between forcing people to see and experience suffering on this scale and presenting it so graphically that people can't look, that they overload.
Well, this is exactly the balance that I'm trying to strike, in that it's very important to for people to understand the gravity of a certain situation, the depth of the tragedy, the unacceptability of the situation, and yet still make a human statement so that people can relate to it. But the fact is, it is important to shake people up, because these are not generic situations. They're not illustrations that something happened out there. They are grave, deep tragedies that are occurring to thousands of people. And they have to be portrayed in a strong way, or I don't believe they're honest. I think if a magazine or any kind of publication or a television broadcast portrays these tragedies in a generic way that's easy to look at, then people don't become concerned with them in the way that they should. It just becomes a commodity as a kind of news item. And I think that the audience that we are all trying to reach deserves more than that. And I think they can take more than that. And I think they're capable of responding to more than that. And to give them less is to not give them credit for their own humanity.
You took a photo of another Rwandan man, a Hutu. It's a close-up of his face in profile. His face fills the whole frame, and it looks as if a knife or machete has slashed four or five gashes into his face, all radiating out from behind his ear. The tip of his ear is cut off. The gashes are healed. Could you tell us this man's story?
I can tell it to you as much as I could get it from him. He did not speak English. I did not speak his language, so what I learned was through an interpreter. He could barely speak. He was so badly damaged. But I did understand that he was a Hutu, not a Tutsi. The genocide was directed specifically at the Tutsi tribe by the Hutus. However, this man did not support the genocide. He showed compassion for his neighbors and countrymen, despite what their tribe was, and was punished for it. He was put into the same death camp that the Tutsis were in, and he was obviously worked over very badly with machetes and starved as well. This was the price he had to pay for doing the right thing.
Did you ask the man to pose that way? Or was he saying, you need to take this photo, look what they did to me?
The dynamic between us was very interesting. I was in a International Red Cross clinic that had been closed until then. The people who were being liberated from the death camp were being brought there. And I was there when the man was brought in. And I went over to him and approached him quietly, looked him in the eye, made him aware of my presence, and began to photograph him. He obviously tacitly accepted me photographing him because he didn't object. He didn't try and shy away. He was allowing me to photograph his wounds. And at one point, he even lifted his face slightly more into the light through no prompting of my own. It was just something he was really giving me and giving the people who he knew were going to see this picture. He was allowing what had happened to him to speak for what had happened to hundreds of thousands of his countrymen. And it was all done wordlessly.
My guest is photojournalist James Nachtwey. He is a contract photographer for Time magazine. He's a member of the prestigious photo agency Magnum. He has a new book called Inferno. It documents the victims of war, famine, and crisis from the last decade with photos from Somalia, Sudan, Rwanda, Bosnia, Chechnya, and Kosovo. James, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is photojournalist James Nachtwey. His photos of war and conflict in such places as Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia, Kosovo, and other nations are collected in a new book. It's called Inferno. You said you felt you were documenting something akin to a biblical plague in this, documenting the cholera epidemic in this camp. Did that raise images in your mind, which in turn you find surfacing in your work, I mean, a way of framing almost in biblical composition? And I'm thinking of a picture of a woman supporting her husband. He has cholera, and she's waiting for him to get treated, to get medical treatment. His head is in her lap. His face fills half the frame. His eyes are just in it.
Yes, I know the picture you're speaking of.
They're inexpressible. They're both dead and alive.
I interact very directly with the situations I'm in. I'm not thinking of imagery from the past. I'm not seeking to reproduce motifs that have been created earlier in history. It's a very direct and immediate relationship I have visually with the events that I'm covering and the people that I'm photographing. I do find it interesting that quite often my pictures, as well as pictures of many of my colleagues, can resemble biblical scenes as portrayed by artists in earlier eras. And I have thought about that. And the only conclusion I can come to is that those artists themselves were painting from life, that they were, in a way, sanctifying life by portraying the scenes of everyday people as if they were happening to biblical characters. And I think that is the source of art, is life itself. And we don't have to go back and refer to something that was portrayed earlier. It's there now. And if the scenes that were photographed in Rwanda look biblical, it's because that was the magnitude of the situation.
It's interesting that we think of photojournalism as capturing this one moment, and the photo becomes an icon for a whole conflict or a whole people or a whole situation and the experience of a whole nation. But when you look at your book, a book of this length, there are many series of photos. You create a kind of action in the photos. There's a series of burial photos from countries in conflict all over the world, families burying family members and mourning. There's a series of photos that depict a body being found in the midst of a fighting situation, of a neighbor stumbling on a dead body, and what happens after that. You tell stories. When you're shooting the photos, are you thinking of a narrative? Are you thinking of the story as it's in process? And does that affect how you choose what to take a photo of?
I'm very interested in creating narrative structures using my photographs, and that is how I'm reacting to those situations when I'm there. I think within each chapter of the book, there are overarching themes, and within those themes, there are smaller stories, more intimate stories, that I quite often do on a spread of several pictures, where I'm trying to follow what's happening to one individual. So it becomes a story within a story. It's kind of an eddy in the larger stream, and then the book continues on into the larger themes.
You have a chapter on the Chechnya in your new book. There's a photo of civilians pinned down by a barrage of fire from Russian tanks. They're lying down on the ground against a wall. You must be in front of them shooting the picture. You must also, it seems, be somehow out in the open or against the wall. You can see the fear and the tension on the young man's face. It's really, it's chilling. Could you talk about how you actually took that shot?
This tank barrage occurred unexpectedly, and a few people were killed immediately. Everyone in the area who was out in the open immediately took cover as much as they could. I found myself pretty much in the open. There was a wall of a building between me and some of the tank fire, but it was coming in very rapidly in a very flat trajectory. I just repeated shelling that went on for quite a long time. And I was pinned down exactly with these two men who you see in the photograph.
Do you wear a flak jacket?
Sometimes I do. I never really wore one until the war in Bosnia. And I wore one there from time to time, and in Chechnya most of the time, because living inside Grozny for a couple of weeks, you very quickly understood that you could be taken out any time of the day, any place you happened to be. There was no safe place. The shells were coming down indiscriminately and seemingly randomly wherever you went. And it was a mild precaution.
Has your attitude towards yourself or your own safety changed over these decades now that you've covered wars?
Facing risk is simply part of the job. It comes with the territory. I understood it very quickly and have accepted it. Several of my friends have been killed doing this, and I think that we all understand that it could happen to any of us, and it's very important not to be reckless. I think you have to get in tune with what's going on around you. You cannot let fear paralyze you. You have to let it activate your awareness so that you become tuned in and better able to both do your job and survive.
You must, though, make decisions about what to risk and what not to. I'm curious what you weigh, and I'm thinking of a photo that was taken of you taking a photo. It's in the midst of a fighting in South Africa. You're sitting on the ground. You're taking a photo of a young man with a gun in his hands facing you. You're both out in the open. Your back is to the shooting. And behind you, there are 10, 20 photojournalists lying flat on the ground farther away, but you're sitting up with your back to the firing. You made a choice to come in close and to take the risk. What was happening in that situation, and how did you make that decision?
There was a battle that day going on between the followers of the ANC and workers in a Zulu hostel. And it was quite heavy firing. 10 people were killed that day alone in that very vicinity. It was a battle with machine guns. Heavy fire was coming into that area, and that's why you see so many people lying flat on the ground. Actually, most of them are people from the neighborhood. There are a couple of photojournalists, but if you look a little more carefully, you'll see that most of the people there are citizens of that area. And I don't exactly remember the thought process that was going on in my mind when I was making this picture, but I can only say that it must have been some kind of calculated risk. I definitely made myself vulnerable to the incoming fire, and I must have felt there was a very good reason to take that risk at that moment.
Did that young man that you were taking a photograph of survive?
Yes. I don't know if he survived the entire day, but during the time that I was with him, he did survive.
James Nachtwey, his new book of war photography of the past decade is called Inferno. We'll hear more of our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with award-winning photojournalist James Nachtwey. He's a member of the Magnum Photo Agency and on contract to Time magazine. He has a new book of photos taken in the last decade of victims of war and crisis in such places as Romania, Sudan, Rwanda, Bosnia, and Chechnya. It's called Inferno. I think you said once that you've learned to see in accelerated time, that you don't set things up. Can you talk about that? What does that mean?
I think it's similar to what an athlete experiences. Things happen incredibly fast. They're very chaotic. They're unpredictable. And as a photographer, I try and synchronize my own mental state and my own movements to the pace of what's going on around me. And sometimes I'm able to make a photograph that looks very composed and very studied, and all the elements are in the right place, and there's the right relation between the foreground and background, and the proportions are correct. And it all happened in a small fraction of a second. It was perceived, framed, and shot almost instantaneously. And that's what I mean by accelerated seeing. You're just seeing things faster than normal people would. An analogy might be to athletics, where someone playing football could see a ball more clearly and slower than a normal person could because of their training and whatever physical abilities they have and because of the situation they're in.
Have you intervened in situations when you were taking photographs in order to prevent someone from getting hurt?
On several occasions. Most of the time it was effective and I managed to save someone. Not always. But there are times when I felt that as a human being I could make a difference. I could actually intervene and save someone from being killed.
What was an example of a time you put your camera down?
Oh, there was a time in Haiti when the American Armed Forces intervened there, and a lynch mob was chasing a man and beating him, and obviously were going to kill him. And I saw a moment when I could actually step into the middle of it, stop them for a moment, and pull the man out, put him in my vehicle, and drive away with him. They were accusing him of being a government collaborator. I had no idea whether he was or he wasn't. I just knew that I could not sit by and watch them beat this man to death when I had the possibility of doing something about it. I went back to that neighborhood the next day, and the people told me that in fact he was not a government collaborator, that someone had some kind of personal score to settle with him and had started this kind of witch hunt. And because there was a mob mentality, people were irrational. There was a time in South Africa when a man was about, who was already wounded by a mob and was about to be finished off, and I stepped in and put him in my car and drove away with him. There have been several occasions like that, and I think that I didn't do anything that any other journalist wouldn't have done as well. There's a time when you have to be a human being before you're a photographer. And I think it's a common misconception about photojournalists that we don't help, that we're just taking advantage of a situation. And I think that the facts are quite different, that we're trying to help the situation by virtue of our work. And most of the time when we're photographing something where someone is wounded, where someone is starving, they're already being cared for by either a humanitarian organization or by their comrades or by a combat medic, and there's nothing more that we can do. We're superfluous other than to do our job as journalists. And I think it's important for the public to understand that.
There's a series of photographs you took in Somalia of a father tending his starving son at an emergency relief station. And I imagine it must be so difficult for you to keep your emotions in check, to concentrate, because it must take great concentration to do the kind of work that you do. Can you talk about what it is like to focus on, what it was like to focus on this family in this instance?
It's extremely difficult to watch people suffer, and in particular to watch people starve to death. It's an extremely painful process, and it's very hard to watch. And you do have to keep your emotions in check. You have to channel your anger, your disbelief, your compassion into your work so that you can make effective photographs that will reach people, that the emotional content that you're feeling, you're able to put into your work. And it takes quite a bit of discipline and I think a sense of purpose in order to overcome these kind of emotional obstacles.
Are there times you turn away? I'm thinking in this case, the son died, and a moment later, there's a photo, you took a photo of a woman who also looks to be starving to death, who's blind, and her hand is moving over the boy's face who just died.
To go to places such as Somalia or Chechnya or anywhere else where there's a massive tragedy taking place with a camera assumes responsibility, that you're going there for a purpose. And I believe in that purpose. And as much as I want to turn away sometimes, I would be forsaking my duty if I did turn away.
Photojournalist James Nachtwey, his new book of war photos from the past decade is Inferno.